Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of A New Kind of Celebrity. I'm your host Venal and I'm excited to bring you another inspiring and insightful conversation this week. At A New Kind of Celebrity, we define the word celebrity differently. We define it as someone worth celebrating. Our guests are people who are doing incredible work to make this world a better place. Join us as we celebrate these individuals and learn from their experiences, leadership, and wisdom. I hope you've had a happy and safe start to 2022. Thank you for all the love and support last year. We hope our second year inspires even more people. To start us off in the new year, we have our guest, Viren Rasquina. Viren Rasquina is an Indian hockey player. He is the former captain of the Indian hockey team and was a member of the team that finished 7th at the Athens Olympics in 2004. He pursued management studies after that, and he now leads an organization called Olympic Gold Quest, which is on a journey to build the future Olympic champions of our country. Thank you so much for joining us, Viren. I'd love if you can start with just talking a little bit about your journey to becoming a hockey player, playing at the Olympics. Can you tell us a little bit about what led you there and how was it actually playing in the Olympics?
Yeah, you know, it's a long story, actually. I started off playing very young. I was very lucky because in my school, St. Stanislaus High School in Bandra, it was one of those old Jesuit schools. We were lucky to have big playgrounds. Mm-hmm. And I think we were lucky to have a very good coach in school. And the name of my school coach was Marcellus Gomes. And he was a hockey Olympian as well. He represented India at the 1984 Los Angeles Olympics. And so from the time I was 9-10 years old and I was hockey training in school, I was very lucky to be taught all the basics in hockey by an Olympian. And who is lucky enough to get an Olympian to teach you when you're a kid? But I think, you know, Marcellus Gomes taught me more than just hockey skills and the technical skills of hockey. I think more importantly, he taught me the importance of hard work and discipline and commitment and teamwork. And I think most importantly, he taught me to believe in myself. And if it wasn't for Marcellus Gomes, I think there's no way I would have gone on to play for the Indian hockey team. And all of us have that one teacher or one professor or one coach that made a mark on our lives, that had an impact on our lives. And I think for me in my hockey career, that was Marcellus Gomes when I was at a very young, impressionable age. So I'm very grateful to him for helping me to believe in myself. So that's where my journey started, I think, playing hockey in school. I'm grateful to my parents as well because, you know, I grew up in the 80s and 90s where, you know, I came from a very conservative middle-class background. Mom was a doctor. My two elder brothers were engineers. You know, my parents, I remember, were super strict with my eldest brother and he ended up taking engineering. They were medium strict with the second guy and he took up engineering as well. And I think I always say I was the lucky one because by the time I came along, my parents were not bothered at all. And that's how, you know, instead of studying, I could actually go and play hockey. But also, I think I would have made a lousy engineer or a doctor because I couldn't understand the equation in school. So I think many people will be glad out there that I didn't become a doctor for sure. The lives of many people are saved. That I had no godfather in hockey. I had no hockey background. No one from my family played hockey. So it was just up to me to figure out the way and the path. And at that point of time, after school, I had many failures on the way. I remember when I was playing for the Mumbai team, when I was trying to get into the Mumbai team, I was dropped almost 3 or 4 times from the squad. I did not make the squad. And I was always the small, puny little kid and I didn't have strength. And I didn't have the right fitness, the right endurance. But I guess over time, I realized those things and you learn from failures a lot. And yeah, I think I consider myself fairly lucky that eventually I could go on to play for the Indian hockey team.
Right. Thank you for sharing that. And I think it's very interesting that you shared that 3 times you weren't selected into the squad. Given that at that age, it's also confusing to know whether sports can actually be a career. If you didn't get selected one time, should you drop out and actually maybe take some other field, another job, shift your line? What sort of kept you going to say, no, this is what I want to make into my career despite the failures and keep going at it?
Yeah, of course. I think especially when it comes to sport in India, and if you come from a metro city, there always comes a time in your life where you have to make a choice, and then those choices come when you reach 10th standard and 12th standard. And like I said, I think for me, what made it easier was, one, I was the youngest in the family. So I had a little bit of flexibility in the sense that my parents were not super strict by that time. And secondly, I was always fairly good in my studies. So I never, while I was playing, I never neglected my studies. I kept studies, I kept working, I kept doing well. So I never, I think, gave them the opportunity to say that I wasn't working on that side as well. I think I loved sport. I loved hockey. It was something that I enjoyed doing. I never took it as a burden. And, you know, when you're a young kid, you think about it as a dream. I remember when I was a young teenager in 1996, to be precise, at the Atlanta Olympics, I watched Leander Paes standing on the Olympic podium. And for me, that was a moment that really inspired me. Like Leander, I wanted to play for India. I wanted to captain the Indian hockey team, wanted to play at the Olympics, wanted to win an Olympic medal as a player. And I was very lucky. The first three dreams got fulfilled. But the final one of actually winning an Olympic medal myself as a player, that remained unfulfilled. But going back to the decision, and despite a failure to keep going, I think it's just, I was able to take it in my stride because I had not sort of stopped studying. I kept doing both simultaneously. And I also, you know, I think there's a sort of myth that if you play sport, you can't study. And I think that if you manage your time effectively, if you're able to switch on and switch off. So when I played sport, I always played sport. And when I came back to study, I made sure I studied. So I never want to waste time. Maybe I sacrificed a little bit of going out with friends, going out for parties. But, you know, for me, honestly, that was never a sacrifice in a way, because it was not something I was interested in. What I was interested in was playing hockey and ensuring that my studies did not suffer. So I think it's how you look at it. There's one thing I've realized about failure in life, that when something, you think much more about it and you think and you analyze and you try to improve on it. Well, if you win or you succeed, you don't think about it too much. You don't really analyze deeply. So the learnings from losing are always far more than the learnings from victory.
Makes sense. And I think it's very interesting to hear about your journey, because typically you're right, there is this sort of belief that if you want to get into sports at an Olympic level, that's all you need to do in the entire day and you can't really do studies or anything else along with it. So it's interesting to hear your journey of balancing both. Maybe Viren, if you could tell us, you spoke a little bit about trying for the Mumbai team and then we know you've played for the Olympics. Can you tell us a little bit about that journey as well as what was it like playing for the Olympics?
I think to finally get into the Indian team for the Olympics, there's just so much competition and so many players vying for limited positions in the Indian team. And in a 16-member Indian squad, I remember there were almost 50 of us training in the national camp. And to get to that 50 was so tough. And then within that 50, to finally make the final 16 was so hard.
Right.
And the toughest part in an athlete's life is dealing with defeat and dealing with injury. And especially in a physical sport like hockey, where by nature of the sport, you lose a lot sometimes. And that takes a toll on you. And secondly, hockey is a physical contact sport, so you get injured a lot as well. And when you get not just the physical aspect of the injury, but the mental aspect of the injury, because then you're out for 2-3 months. It takes a toll on your physical fitness. Again, fitness takes months to build up, but it decelerates very rapidly. And as we see it, you know, when you go past your 30s and into your 40s, you realize that even more. Today, you see a lot of mental health issues, things like that coming up. But in those days, that was not even a point of discussion. There were no sports psychologists, no one you could speak to. So, you know, it's something that sometimes you're on your own, you're dealing with problems, challenges. And, you know, I didn't want to lean on to my family too much because I think it was enough that I felt that they gave me the opportunity to play without putting pressure on me. And if I made it or didn't make it in sport, I wanted it to be on my own. That was the hard part, to deal with it on my own, knowing that I had no family background in it and no one to speak for me. But, you know, in a way, I always wanted that way. I wanted it to be on my own merit. So I think to be an Olympic athlete, it's pushing yourself beyond limits every single day at 6 o'clock in the morning when no one is watching. And there are so many days where you wake up early in the morning and feel like, you know, I don't want to get up today. And, you know, I don't want to go for a run and I don't want to train hard. Or your body is just paining too much. And that's the time you got to push yourself when your body is crying to sleep 15 minutes more or not go for training that day. And I think those are the tough days you got to overcome.
Right.
But for me, I think just that journey was so hard at that time, but it just makes it all the more sweeter. And it makes the memories all the more sweeter.
Makes sense. Yeah, that rigor and discipline, I think, that sports people have is just really, really incredible. And Viren, like, generally, sports people are not known till they, you know, like, are playing for the country at an Olympics, etc. And they receive also a lot of flack when, you know, they don't win medals or they don't win for the country. So it's like you said, a lot of pressure around, especially playing at these stages. So since you played and mentioned that you all didn't win the medal, can you share a little bit of your personal journey? What was it like playing? How did you go through those emotions and maybe some stories around that?
Yeah, you know, so many special stories, actually. You know, when you're playing with the Indian hockey team, there's always the weight of expectation because I think India's had such a glorious history and tradition, especially in hockey at the Olympics, right, where we won Olympic gold medals. But the last one was in 1918 Moscow Olympics. So that was a long, long time ago. And, you know, this time in Tokyo Olympics, after 41 years, India won a hockey team medal, which was incredible for all of us hockey fans and players. But yeah, there's always been pressure. But I think in terms of few of the really good memories I've had is, I remember 1999 when I came into the Indian team for the first time. And I remember when it was announced that I would be in the Indian team, and I remember making the call home to my parents and listening on the phone. And I remember at that time, there were no mobile phones. And you had to go to these SD booths and call back home. And we used to call after 8:30 in the night because it used to be 1/4 charges on calls. I remember calling my mom and dad home, and they were both so happy, and especially my dad, because my dad loves sports as well. I think to hear their voice and to hear the happiness in their voice was an incredible feeling. In 2001, when we won the Junior World Cup, India won the Junior World Cup for the first time ever in Hobart, Australia, and I was part of that team. That was India's first big win at a major tournament after a long time. Of course, we had won the 98 Asian Games as well, but at the World Cup level, first time ever India win Junior World Cup, that was great. 2003, India had a very successful year. We won 4 international tournaments, and there was a lot of hope for the Indian hockey team leading up to the Athens 2004 Olympics. And I remember walking out into that first match at Athens. It was an absolute packed stadium in Athens, and India was playing Holland, and half the stadium was in orange, half the stadium was in blue. And, you know, when you walk out of the dugout onto the hockey pitch and tens of thousands of people stand up and they sing the national anthem, you get goosebumps. So, you know, that's an incredible feeling. So, yeah, many lovely moments that I've had. When I captained the Indian hockey team for the first time in Chandigarh in an India-Pakistan series, again, there were about 35, 40,000 people in the stadium in Chandigarh. And hockey is very popular in Punjab. There were people lined up on the streets, on the roofs of houses, people sitting on trees outside the stadium watching the matches. So it's great to see the love and passion for hockey in places across the country. Those were great moments. I remember that India-Pakistan series. That was the first ever India-Pakistan bilateral series in any sport after the Kargil War. And there were huge tensions during that entire series. I remember when the Indian team went to Pakistan, I've never seen the kind of security that was there for the Indian team. Everything was in lockdown everywhere we went, and the hotel was entirely sanitized. The road from the airport to the hotel was totally sanitized. There were bomb squads everywhere we went because there was so much scrutiny on that series, being the first time we played Pakistan after the Kargil War. So, yeah, just amazing memories over the years. And, you know, at that time also, smartphones weren't there. So, you know, you don't have too many photos and videos from that time, but so all memories are just in my head mostly.
And I know, Viren, in another setting, you had shared about like a defining match, I think at the Athens Olympics, that really like made a deep impact. I think it was the defining match for India there. Could you maybe share a little bit about that as well?
Yeah, so India was playing Australia in a very crucial league match at the Athens Olympics, and it was critical for India to win that match, try and make it to the semi-finals of the Athens Olympics. Australia, as we know, is an extremely strong team in world hockey, just like they are in cricket as well. And we scored the first goal in the first half. Australia equalized. It was 1-1 at halftime. In the second half, Dhanraj Pillai got a yellow card and he was sidelined for around 10 minutes. And in that 10-minute period in the second half, and that time hockey was two halves of 35 minutes as opposed to now four quarters of 15 minutes each. So in that 10-minute period in the second half, when Dhanraj got a yellow card, Australia scored two goals. So they were leading 3-1. India made it 3-2. With around 7 minutes left on the clock, India made it 3-3.
Oh, wow.
And we were throwing in sync at Australia because we really had to get that winning goal. And with a few minutes left on the clock, we hit the Australian goalpost. The ball hit the post and came back into play. With 2 seconds left on the clock, we had a free hit on top of the Australian D area, the circle. And besides our goalkeeper, all 10 of us went on top to try and score. And in that last minute, what happened in a blur, because in our urgency to try and score, one of us made a mistake. The Australians intercepted the ball. They counter-attacked us. And with 20 seconds left on the clock, Australia scored the winning goal that night. They won that 4-3. I remember that match finished around 10 p.m. Athens time. I remember crying on the sidelines till around 12 midnight. Because for me, it was around 6-7 years into preparing for the Olympics. I remember being very angry and frustrated, not because India lost, not because one of us made a mistake, but I was frustrated at the system, which I feel did not gear us well enough to handle the pressure of taking on the best teams in the world. And that Australian men's hockey team went on to win the gold medal at Athens 2004 for the first time ever in their history. And India and me participated. I think why, for me, this was such a significant match, because it just taught me that at the highest level of sport, the margin between winning a gold medal or simply participating can literally be the width of a goalpost or 20 seconds left on the clock. The margins at that level are very, very fine. If there's one thing I've learned over the years in high performance sport, it's the one percenters that make a difference. And if we get 1% better in fitness, in skill, in equipment, in infrastructure, in coaching, in recovery, in nutrition, that's cumulatively 6 or 7%. And in a team sport, hockey, if you multiply that by 16 players in the team, that's a significant margin. So it's not rocket science, but we have to get 1% better in everything that we do.
I love that, because I feel it illustrates the importance of that micro improvement so much, which I guess sometimes gets neglected in other fields, but it's so evident, like you said, in sports. So Viren, what was your journey like after you played hockey or you retired from hockey? And I know now you're doing some very interesting work with Olympic Gold Quest. So maybe you can just share a little bit of your journey from playing hockey to leading Olympic Gold Quest.
Yeah, I retired at a fairly young age of around 27. And for many people, it was a bit strange, because at 15, I was actually a merit lister on the Mumbai SSE merit list. And at that time, everyone and their uncle wanted me to study, but I wanted to play hockey. And at the age of 27, when I actually decided to retire and study, that time everyone wanted me to play hockey and I wanted to study. So, you know, in a way, like, came a full circle. I always knew that I wanted to do my further studies, but from the age of 19 to 7-8 years that I was there in the Indian team, I think all I did 11 months in a year was just play, train, travel all over the world. I think I didn't open a single book during those 8 years, because it was just so hectic and so tough. And I always knew that there would come a time when I would want to move on. And like I said, many people felt that I could play for another Olympic cycle, but in my mind, that was it. And I wanted to quit when I was at the peak of my game. And I was studying for my GMAT. I got a reasonably good score. I applied for Indian School of Business, ISB Hyderabad. I got in and I just thought that would be the right opportunity and the right transition for me from the sporting world into the corporate world. And that's how I decided to quit. I finished ISB in 2009. That was an amazing year in my life. I learned a lot, made lifelong friends in that 1 year. Great batch. That was also a very tough year. The economy, as you know, that was a global financial meltdown. there was a Satyam scandal. Our dean had to resign of ISB.
Right.
Jobs were scarce. I had a conventional corporate job, which I signed up. I was about to start. And then I happened to meet Geet Sethi and Prakash Padukone, two legends of Indian sport. And they had started this not-for-profit organization called Olympic Gold Quest with a mission to help Indian athletes win Olympic gold medals. And they were looking for a CEO. Now, Geet and Prakash for me were gods in the sporting world. And I couldn't say no to them. But also for me, in a way, OGQ gave me a platform to help the next generation of athletes do something that I couldn't do, which is win Olympic medals. And I wanted to help that next generation and ensure that the mistakes that were done during my playing career were not repeated for the next generation of athletes. And that's how my journey with OGQ began. It was just an idea on paper. We had no athletes, we had no funds, we had no idea of how to go about things. And in a way, I like that because Geet and Prakash and Vishwanathan Anand and the OGQ board gave me a blank slate and to paint my own picture and to put together my own team and to put together the strategy and to implement. So for me, that was great because I had the freedom to implement what I always had in mind for Indian sport, the Olympic sport. So, yeah, it's been a great journey over the last 12 years. Very proud to say today we look after the training of almost 230 of India's best young athletes.
Wow.
About 190 of them from Olympic sports and around 40 of them from Paralympic sport.
Hmm.
In Tokyo Olympics, India won a total of 7 medals. And 4 of the 7 medal winners were supported by OGQ.
Wow.
At the Paralympics. India won a total of 19 medals and 10 of the 19 Paralympic medal
wow.
winners, their training was up OGQ. So it's been an incredible journey, so inspirational to be a part of the journey of athletes like PV Sindhu, MC Mary Kom, Saina Nehwal, some of the para athletes, athletes with physical disabilities, athletes with amputations, athletes on wheelchairs. And I think, you know, when you see a mother of four like MC Mary Kom, who's 38 years old. She was the oldest boxer in the history to participate at the Olympics. When you see a 38-year-old mother of four punishing herself every single day at 5:30 in the morning because she dreams of winning an Olympic medal, then there's really no excuse for any of us about anything in life. I think seeing people like Mary Kom and Saina and Sindhu over the years, ready to run through a brick wall every single day in training. For me, that's something I love, that and giving it everything we have, because I think we all live this one life. I think for me, sport teaches you how to live on the edge and give it everything you have.
Right. That's really inspiring, the kind of outcomes OGQ is leading today. And like you mentioned, the different individual journeys. Can you share more of what does Olympic Gold Quest actually do to enable that we have? I mean, the kind of success that you've seen. What actually is the journey? What do you contribute to the sports person? If you can walk us through a little bit of the what entails the support.
So first of all, we start by identifying the most talented young athletes. Of these 230 athletes that I mentioned, I think almost 106 of them are junior athletes in the age group of 11. 19 years old. These are some of the most talented young kids in the country. There are various filtration processes. First of all, we support athletes only from Olympic or Paralympic sports. Second is only individual sports, not my sport, which is hockey. By the way, hockey is the only team sport that India qualifies for at the Olympics or is even remotely qualifying. The third filtration process is we have a pool of 9 sports that we support athletes, but primarily 5 sports. Those 5 sports are badminton, boxing, shooting, archery, and wrestling. Why these 5? Because all the data over the last decade shows that these are the 5 sports where India has the best chance of winning Olympic medals. If you look at current pool of talent, pipeline of talent for the future. Also, if you look at the Olympic medal tally of the last 5 Olympics, and you look at the top 25-30 nations in the medal tally, you will see that most of these nations win around 70-75% of their medals from only 4 sports. So the lesson here is to win Olympic medals, you have to focus. especially in a country like India where resources for sport are limited, if you go too wide, you'll end up supporting everyone but winning nothing. So OGQ, I think the DNA of OGQ should be very focused and intensely focused and go really deep in the journey to win Olympic medals. So once we support an athlete, the journey is generally a long term. Like I said, we started supporting Sindhu when she was 14 years old and she won the Olympic medal at the age of 21 years old. We support athletes in terms of ensuring they have the right coaching, be it Indian or foreign coaches, the right training facilities, be it in India or abroad. We ensure they have the right equipment. So in sports like shooting and archery, equipment is critical. It's very expensive. It's not standardized. Very often it has to be imported from abroad. Take, for example, a sport like archery. And archery equipment comprises of about 33 parts. The archery equipment in totality costs around 4 lakhs. Most of our talented young archers come from remote villages in Jharkhand, Chhattisgarh, Sikkim, Manipur. These talented young kids who are 13, 14 years old cannot afford such expensive equipment. And if we do not identify the kids at the right age and give them the right equipment along with the right coaching, by the time they're 18, 19, 20 and come into the Indian team, it's too late. They have to actually unlearn what they have learned to be able to handle such complicated equipment. And that's why it's critical to identify the talented kids early and put them in the right training environment. And that's what OGQ majorly tries to do. We have also put together a team of world-class doctors, physios, nutritionists, mental trainers, everyone who works behind the scenes. Because if we expect our athletes to win Olympic gold medals, then everyone working behind the scenes has to be world-class. So that's in a nutshell of what OGQ does. Maybe I'll narrate it in the form of a story of, say, MC Mary Kom. We all know MC Mary Kom as the legendary boxer. She's the only boxer in the world, male or female, to win 6 world championship gold medals. She has a total of 8 world championship medals. She's been boxing at this level for 20 years. And I cannot imagine someone taking that amount of punishment over 20 years in one of the most brutal sports ever. And the year was 2009, and it was just announced that women's boxing would be included in the London 2012 Olympics for the first time ever. Until the Beijing 2008 Olympics, boxing was only a men's sport. Since they included women's boxing at London 2012, they introduced only 3 weight categories. In men's boxing, there were 10 weight categories. And the lowest weight category they introduced in women's boxing was 51 kilos. So when I say 51 kilos, it means that you're weighed in at 8 a.m. on the morning of the bout. And you can be 50.99 kilos on the official weighing scale. You can't be 51. Now, Mary was already a world champion, but she was a world champion in the 46 kg weight category. So if you have seen Mary in real life, she's a very tiny, puny lady. To be 46 kilos, you have to be short and tiny. The year was 2009. We had to push her close to 51 because it's always better to be at the upper range of your weight category because every kilo makes a difference to the strength of your punch. Now, we had to also ensure that Mary put on the right kind of weight and not the wrong kind of weight that I have put on post my playing career, which comes in all the wrong. As a boxer, you ensure that boxers put on all muscle and no fat to enable to retain their speed and power and intensity. I think with the right kind of nutrition, scientific nutrition plan and training program, I think that was the easier part. Over 3 years to put on 5 kilos, that was not easy for a 46 kg boxer because that's putting on almost 10% of body weight, which is huge in elite sport. The next challenge was height. Because when you go up weight categories, Mary was going to go up from 46 to 48 to 51. She was going up 2 weight categories. When you go up 2 weight categories, you're fighting against taller boxers who have height and reach advantage, which is a major advantage in boxing. Mary was already 27, so there was no chance of making her grow taller. So what do we do? How do we overcome that challenge? We started researching on foreign coaches, and we narrowed down on this guy called Charles Atkinson from the UK. He was a professional boxing coach who specialized in taking fighters up weight categories and winning world titles. Now again, the year was 2009. We had no money. But we somehow managed to convince Charles to leave everything in the UK and come down for the project to win an Olympic medal with Mary Kom. Charles somehow believed us and he came down to India in 2009. We set up training camp based in Balewadi in Pune. On day one, Charles came down, he taught us the first lesson. He said, Viren, if we dream of winning an Olympic medal, we have to get the right sparring partners for Mary. Sparring partners are the boxers she fights with in training. Now, we started researching on all the best women boxers in the world in 51 kg weight category. Some were southpaws, primarily left-handed punchers. Some were orthodox, primarily right-handed punchers. Some were taller opponents. Now, we couldn't find the right female sparring partners because the poor girls were taking so much punishment from Mary in training. They could not give her the right kind of training closer to competition. We could not find the right kind of male sparring partners because men of the same weight category are physically much more stronger than women. Finally, after a lot of search, we narrowed down on three young boys in the age group of 15 to 17 years old. One was a southpaw, one was orthodox, and one was a taller boy. These three young male boxers became Mary's sparring partners for 3 years. In between, Mary had twin sons. One of them had a heart problem, and the kids were in Imphal. Mary was training in Pune. And as a young mother, I could see it before my eyes how hard it was for her to be away from her family, her young kids. And then on top of that, one of them was seriously unwell. We facilitated the surgery, ensured that everything was well taken care of. And it was a very traumatic, emotional period for Mary Kom. And finally, when London 2012 came, it was unheard of in the history of boxing at the Olympics that a boxer went up two weight categories in a lower weight and won an Olympic medal. And when finally Mary stood on the Olympic podium with a bronze medal around her neck, I was standing 10 meters behind the podium with her husband, Onler, and the team. And, you know, all of us cried buckets of tears because it was 3.5 years of effort and many more years for Mary to win that Olympic medal. And just want to add that Mary Kom came from a background so poor that growing up, she didn't even have 2 square meals a day to eat. She never had running shoes. She never had a pair of boxing gloves. She never had a coach till she was 15, 16 years old. And that girl coming from that background went on to win an Olympic medal. And for me, Mary Kom is not just one of the inspirational sports persons I know, but just one of the most inspirational people that I've ever known in my life.
Wow, yeah. I feel like I was getting goosebumps as you were narrating that. Taking from the story, Viren, like every sport is so technical, right? Like you said, some have equipment, some, whether it's techniques, etc. You also mentioned that, you know, you have to start early. Otherwise, you know, you have to unlearn too many things and it becomes too late to compete at that Olympic level at least. And you also mentioned that most of the players you're supporting or sports people are coming from maybe more remoter parts and not your main towns where exposure might be higher. So how do you go about, or how does your team go about identifying these people? I think that's one. Second is it dependent on prior exposure that they've already had? Like in the case of Mary Kom, you mentioned that she didn't have a coach until 15. How many examples have you seen where people have not had too much high skill input or high exposure to the sport and still make it big in sports?
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting question. The dichotomy of India is that today the metros have the resources, but in sport, where the money is, the talent and the hunger is not there. And where the talent and the hunger is there, the money and the organization is not there. So 90% of the athletes supported by OGQ come from the small towns and villages. They are not coming from Bombay, Delhi, Bangalore and Chennai. Olympic sport is so tough, especially in the physical sports, where you literally got to run through a brick wall every single day. I think in the metros, education is a far bigger opportunity. So you know, I don't blame metro kids because when things get really tough and tough decisions have to be made, it's but natural for parents to take the educational route because that just opens so many more doors. The risks are much less. While in sport, if you're coming from a metro, the risks are much more. But I've seen that coming for a poor kid from a rural background or from the small towns or village, for them, sport is a way out of a very hard life. So they and their parents do not see it as a risk. They are willing to put everything on the line. They're willing to put their bodies on the line and they're willing to give it everything. And to make it to that level, just passion is not enough. I think persistence is an underrated quality, which is so important for every athlete, because there are going to be many, many times that you're going to fail, and there are going to be many, many times that you're going to lose. And you have to be able to show the perseverance and persistence to stick through those hard times. And I think kids coming from small towns have that much more hunger and fire and desire in them. Most of these kids growing up have not had the right facilities, the right equipment, the right coaches. So when we are researching, the data available to us can't be just quantitative data. We have to factor qualitative inputs, because it is not a level playing field. If a shooter or an archer takes part in tournaments without having the right archery equipment, then it's not a level playing field. So we have to always factor that. If a young talented kid has a very good coach and another young talented kid does not have any coach at all, you have to factor into that. And I think we have been able to put the right processes in place over the last decade by just having trusted scouts on the ground. These are mostly coaches who are experts in that field and are able to identify the most talented young kids at an early age. So it's not just important to identify kids at an early age, but it's important to put them under the right coach. Of all the ingredients that go into the mix of building Olympic and world champions, the coach is the most important ingredient. If we don't get the right coaches for our young kids, no matter what we do, India will not win Olympic medals. So just as we teach the right basics in maths or English or Hindi or science to young kids in school, it's also important to teach the right basics to the kids, like Marcellus Gomes taught me when I was 9, 10, 11 years old.
Got it. And the prerequisite would be, though, that they're already playing that sport. It's not identifying children so young and building from scratch, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. They, not just they're playing the sport, but they've already achieved to a certain level. There are thousands of kids playing that particular sport, but we set very stringent benchmarks before coming into the program. So our research team would be observing for at least 1 year before we start supporting the athlete. And recommendations come to us both ways. We proactively scout for athletes. We get hundreds and hundreds of recommendations also. And we would continuously be observing, researching. Consistency is another parameter that we lay great emphasis on, and not just a one-off performance. So that's also something that we look at, because once you select a young athlete, it's going to be an investment of 6, 7, 8 years before you will even possibly qualify for the Olympics. Just to give you an idea of numbers, we were preparing around 100 athletes in 2016. At the time of the Rio Olympics, we were preparing around 100 athletes for the Rio Olympics. Sorry, for the Tokyo 2020 Olympics, which got pushed to Tokyo 21. Out of those 100, around 29 qualified for the Tokyo Olympics. Out of those 29, 4 ultimately won medals. So that's the kind of cut. And to get those 100, we would have been researching on a few thousand athletes across the country. So those are the kind of numbers, just to give you an idea.
Right. And I think, Viren, for since you've seen the journey of so many different athletes, both as a player and through OGQ, when you see the most successful, and defining success either with Olympic gold, but I'm sure also just different tournaments, different world championships, when you see people who are very, very successful, there's a lot of debate in different fields, right? Knowledge, skills, mindset, which one sort of plays out more, or which is more important to teach, to train, to build. From your experience in the context of sports, what have you seen? What are those ingredients that become more critical between skill, attitude, or mindset?
I think a little bit of it all. All those qualities are important. For champions, you can't have one and not have the other. But I think beyond a certain point, more than just talent, it's also just sheer effort and hard work, something working beyond what people can imagine and pushing the limits beyond human endeavor. And I think that's why I love sport, because the athletes who go on to win Olympic medals are pushing the limits every single day. That's a very fine line, because when we train athletes, you have to push them to the limits, but you have to also be careful not that you don't push them over the limit, because then there's a chance of getting injured. So that line is very fine. If you don't push them hard enough, there's someone else in the world, somewhere else, working harder and being fitter, faster, stronger than you are. And at the same time, if you push them too much, the risk of getting injury and then losing out on time before you recover. So those are very fine lines. And athletes have to have all the qualities that you mentioned. You know, when you think of it from the corporate world, corporates today want all qualities that athletes have, actually, from teamwork to goal setting to discipline to commitment, having a never say die attitude. So if I think the qualities of athletes are something that would also be so good in the corporate world as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think sports teaches, whether you played at a international level, national level, I think just sports, anywhere where you're competing, I think the amount of discipline it just builds and transferable skills it builds for life is definitely incredible. Viren, I have one last question, which is just understanding what advice and learnings do you have to share with anyone who's listening? But before that, maybe if there's anything else you want to add that we've not covered that you feel would be important to add, we can cover that.
I think, you know, growing up, we always criticize the government a lot, but I've actually seen, especially in the last 5, 7, 10 years, actually the government support to sport especially has been much more. And that is manifested in actually really strong professional bureaucrats working. I never enjoyed working with the government before, but in the last 7 to 10 years, actually the bureaucrats involved in sport have been very professional, very efficient, very intelligent. And I think decision-making has been much quicker. And I think we need really strong bureaucracy and administration in every sport. Without good, an organization like Olympic Gold Quest, we are a small private organization with small budgets. What we are doing is a drop in the ocean. To make change in Indian sport, we have to work at the grassroots level. And the government has the bandwidth and the money and the funds. I think I would love to just see a sea of change of attitude towards sport, because I think this sport can be such a powerful tool to teach our kids so many life lessons that the classroom can never teach us, in terms of their communication skills, in terms of their teamwork skills, in the ability to take defeat and know that you'll get another opportunity to come back in life. And just to make our kids more resilient and strong, I think sport is very beautiful to teach them the right values and right lessons. And it starts from all of us at the family unit and in school and the principal in school. So I think this attitudes in society are very critical. In terms of my learnings, I think, like I said, you learn more from defeat than from a victory. And it's okay to lose sometimes. So that's something that sport always taught me. And I think that it takes courage to succeed. It's far easier to lose and to give up. But if you want to succeed, I think you really have to have something deep within you and the courage. And I think sport has given me that courage. And I think each one has to find that from somewhere deep within. It's not something that is available on a platter. You got to find that from somewhere deep within. So yeah, I think for me, those are the two important lessons.
Thank you so much, Viren. This was very motivating and inspiring. I think your journey, the journey of people you've been supporting, as well as just the impact OGQ has had. I just loved having this conversation with you. And thank you so much for all the work that you're doing.
Yeah, thank you so much, Vinil. You know, it's great when you see, you know, in 2009, when we started supporting Marycom, Mary used to tell me that no parent in the country wanted their daughters to take up boxing. Today, the number of young girls, especially in Punjab, Haryana, and the Northeast, who want to take up boxing are so many that the boxing academies are not enough to intake all these young girls. In 2009, when we started supporting Saina and Sindhu, there were around 30 badminton courts in Hyderabad. Today, there are over 600 badminton courts just in Hyderabad, just in Bangalore. And so you can imagine the thousands and thousands of people across the country who are playing badminton. You know, although India won quite a few medals, our most ever medals at this Olympics, for me, the one biggest impact at the Tokyo Olympics was a team that did not win a medal. And that was the Indian women's hockey team. They came fourth, which is an outstanding performance from a team that had finished last at the Rio Olympics. And around 9-10 girls of that team come from small, poor villages in Haryana. I think growing up, they couldn't wear jeans. Growing up, couldn't have a mobile phone. Many girls in their villages still get married at 17, 18 years old. They don't have the choice to select someone of their own choice to get married to. I can just imagine the power of those images of those girls celebrating on TV when they beat Australia, to millions of young girls watching all over the country on TV. I think just the power of the dream and to not be afraid that they can do whatever they want in life. I think sport gives you that power that very few other sectors, I think, give you that power. So I think it's important to have really powerful role models. And I love the fact that most of our heroes in Olympic sport today are women, from Mary Kom to Sindhu to Saina to Vinesh Fogart to Mirabai Chanu. I think we have women role models everywhere. And when they succeed, I think the story is that much more powerful. I mean, we can't have Salman and Sanjay Dutt as our only role model.
Yeah, absolutely. The ripple effect of anyone making it that big in sports, I think, just uplifts, not just with pride, but with that belief that maybe you can also aspire towards that. Definitely. Thank you so much, Viren. I really, really enjoyed having this conversation.
Thank you, Vinil. It was really a pleasure. And thank you for inviting me to be a part of it. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode. If you liked this episode, do subscribe to the podcast and follow us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or LinkedIn. We'd love to hear your suggestions, reactions, or even guest nominations. You can DM us on Instagram. Our handle is @anewkindofcelebrity, or email us at anewkindofcelebrity@gmail.com. We look forward to meeting you soon. Till then, good luck and take care.